from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, when Elizabeth Warren ended her bid for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination, she mentioned all the promises she'd made with little girls that running for president is what girls do.
One of the hardest parts of this is all those pinky promises and all those little girls who are going to have to wait 4 more years. That's going to be hard.
Warren's campaign called for rooting out corruption, breaking up big tech, canceling student debt. And some of her plans seem to be resonating with voters. So what brought down the once soaring campaign? We get your thoughts after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Last fall, Elizabeth Warren was soaring in the polls. She was drawing huge crowds with people waiting in line for hours to take a selfie with her. But when voting began, she couldn't win a state primary and even came in third in her home state of Massachusetts. Yesterday, Warren ended her bid for the presidency. In farewell remarks to her staff, Warren said her campaign showed that, quote, a woman can stand up, hold her ground, and stay true to herself no matter what. But campaign watchers wonder how much her gender played a role in the campaign's downfall. We look at what happened to Senator Warren's once promising campaign with Shane Goldmacher. He's national political reporter for The New York Times. Hi, Shane Goldmacher.
Good morning.
Also with us is Kelly Dittmar. She's assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden, and scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. Her books include A Seat at the Table, Congresswoman's Perspective on Why They're Representation Matters, and Navigating Gendered Terrain, Stereotypes and Strategy in Political Campaigns. Also with us is Amanda Renteria. She's a Democratic strategist and senior advisor for Emerge America, which seeks to recruit and train Democratic women to run for office. She was national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential run. Welcome, Amanda Renteria.
Thank you.
And welcome to you, Kelly Dittmar.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start with you, though, Shane Goldmacher. I mean, can you just tell us what Elizabeth Warren was doing right? What were the strengths of her campaign that were the envy of some of the others?
In late 2019, she had emerged as one of the front runners in the race and seen as really the chief rival to Joe Biden, largely on the strength of her ideas and the policy proposals that she rolled out. She presented a progressive vision that got a lot of people excited on the left. But in October, she hit a stumbling block at a debate where she was asked about how she would pay for her Medicare for All proposal. She basically aligned herself with Bernie Sanders on Medicare for All, and neither of them had a plan for exactly how they were going to pay for it. But she really took heat on that, especially given how detailed all her other policies had been. So it was on the strength of her policies and on the political organization she built. In those early states, Iowa and New Hampshire, she hired more people than everyone else. She hired them earlier than everyone else. And other campaigns were saying she actually hired better people than they had deep into the communities in Iowa. And people thought, you know, she was going to lock down that first state and potentially become the Democratic nominee. And obviously, that's not the way it turned out.
Yes. One of the other things that was really noted about her was that she was able to raise so much money without initially holding, and I don't know if she ever did, these really high dollar fundraisers that we often see other candidates do.
Yeah. From the beginning of her campaign, they made a decision. They were going to try to do what Bernie Sanders did 4 years ago, which is don't hold any fundraisers in private with big, rich donors. Instead, raise money in small donations from people online and on the internet. And when you talk about what the legacy of her campaign is going to be, I think this is going to be part of it, actually a really important part of it, which is Bernie Sanders showed 4 years ago that you could compete just with small donations, that could happen, right? But he had developed this really unique, excited fan base that people gave over and over and over. And what Elizabeth Warren's campaign has shown, and she raised more than $110 million, is that it wasn't just a Bernie Sanders phenomenon, but that other Democrats could conceivably break away from the traditional private fundraisers that are catered events hosted by wealthy contributors, often who want something for their own agenda politically, and instead raise money from the masses in small chunks online. And so her ability to do that, along with Sanders again, shows that that pathway not just exists, but in some ways is that the better pathway to fund your campaign financially. Both of them outraised on a regular basis Joe Biden's campaign throughout 2019 and early 2020.
So much hope, such a model, Amanda Renteria. I understand you've heard from a lot of women after Elizabeth Warren suspended her campaign yesterday. What were they saying to you?
Yeah, there was, even there was quite a few folks who were really looking at this race, and whether they were with her or not, the idea of having a woman on that stage made a difference, especially when you think about the, you know, what's happened in 2017 and in 2018 and 2019. It almost felt like a stifling, we hit that glass ceiling again. And how many times I heard from folks sending messages and texts saying, God, why does this keep feeling this way, that we can't quite break through, no matter what kind of candidates, no matter the circumstances? What is it going to actually take for a woman to finally be in that space and win?
Well, before we get to the obvious, or at least let's say, before we get to the question of sexism, I would love to hear from you, Kelly Dittmar, just one or two of your theories of what hurt her campaign where it isn't necessarily obvious that sexism was involved.
Sure. I mean, I think gender is always part of this equation. So it's hard to separate out the ways in which gender informs some of what would be deemed more traditional aspects of the campaign that contribute to success or defeat. For me, I think one of the things that she pointed out in both her press conference and interview last night with Rachel Maddow, I think is fair, that there was something in the electorate, a sort of concern or wariness of there being a middle lane that she said she was trying to inhabit. I think two things were happening there. It was hard for her to, quote unquote, inhabit that middle lane as somebody who had actually, as Shane noted, really come in as a progressive candidate. And also, she was competing there with Bernie Sanders. And also, she noted, right, that it seemed like voters were especially concerned that they didn't want to choose somebody who didn't fit one or the other lane, that was the most electable. And that's where I think it's really hard to separate out gender. Because all of our conversations around electability, while you could argue they also were about partisanship and where she stood ideologically, they were totally imbued with concerns about the idea that a woman could win the presidency. So it's hard to separate those out. But I do think that's one space where she said as well, it seemed like voters weren't ready to buy her argument that she was the best person in terms of her ideological position.
Amanda Renteria, there were some folks who also thought she just peaked too early. What do you think about that?
You know, momentum matters, and it just does. I mean, as we're all seeing since South Carolina, having your moments, having that momentum at exactly the time where voters are going to go into the booth, it just does matter. However, you know, I think one of the things in this election cycle that we have to understand is name ID was a very big deal. And the fact that Bernie and Biden from the very beginning had that meant they did not have to dig out of the hole for people to get to know them. And really, for Elizabeth Warren, she had to do that. And that's very, very difficult in a when there's so many people running at the same time and you can't break through.
Well, Shane Goldmacher, Kelly Dittmar brought up also this issue of electability. And I have to say, in reading a lot of analyses about Elizabeth Warren's campaign, I kept seeing that come up consistently, that there was this, that Democrats are obsessed with who can beat Donald Trump, and that in a year like that, they just didn't have the appetite for somebody who may be viewed as more risky because she's a woman. Do you think there's some truth to that?
I mean, I heard it across the country, especially from women voters for the last 6 months. There's a lot of truth to that. And there was this almost perverse thing that happened this year with Democratic primary voters, which is, and again, especially among women, this real awareness after watching Hillary Clinton lose in 2016 that maybe sexism is not just as prevalent as they thought it was, but that it's as impactful in the voting booth. And watching Hillary Clinton's defeat almost made it harder for some of those voters, even as they saw women win so many critical races in the House in 2018, made them just nervous about backing a female candidate for president in 2020. I mean, I remember really distinctively, this isn't with Elizabeth Warren, but with Kirsten Gillibrand, another one of the four women senators who ran. I went with her on her first trip to Iowa, and I met a woman at this event who had started a local women's political group, had hosted Hillary Clinton in her home, was at a Kirsten Gillibrand event, and wasn't sure she would ever be able to support a woman in the Democratic primary because she just was worried that the country was too sexist to ultimately elect a woman over Donald Trump.
I mean, it's pretty amazing, right, that there are a lot of women who had no problem voting for a woman, but were worried that other people wouldn't vote for a woman. And so they themselves didn't vote for a woman either, which then feels like it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. But Amanda Renteria, you were the national political director of Hillary Clinton's campaign. So let's talk a little bit about this, right? Hillary Clinton, in her book, she made the point that sexism contributed to her loss. Do you think in doing that, that she may have made it harder for women to be viewed as electable?
I don't. I think any woman running needs to know when they step into that ring that it is going to be a little bit harder. And we need to be honest about that, not only with the candidates themselves, but as we have this discussion about who leads this country. And I do think part of what's happened here, and it's really interesting because there's so much data from 2018 that shows women can win, and not just win at the House level, not just win in city councils and school boards, but women won quite a few governorships too at the executive level, which used to be the question. And so in some ways, what's happened over the course of this election cycle is almost the invisibility of what happened in 2018. And I think that all came rushing forward as people said, well, how is it that the last woman is getting out when we've had these years of success over and over again in these last 3 years? And that's been really, I think, It's brought Hillary back in the mix, because people almost go back to 2016 as opposed to thinking about the data that just happened right before us.
It's so interesting. I'm reminded now of that debate line that Elizabeth Warren gave about she and Amy Klobuchar were like the only two people on the stage who hadn't lost like multiple races to men. And Kelly Dittmar, what are your thoughts on this whole question of electability, what role gender plays in that question, and how it affected Elizabeth Warren's campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, at the Center for American Women in Politics, we put out the data to show that women were winning at higher rates in 2018, that they ran and won in record numbers, thanks to the work Amanda's group and others were doing as well. So we had the receipts to show that women were not less electable. But we put out a report in the fall also showing that there are these persistent hurdles. But what we know historically is women surpass, they get through those hurdles. Women are used to doing twice as much work to achieve the same outcome as white men. So that sort of concern that people had is something that, you know, they should sort of look at that history, understand that women have been successful. The part of it that I think we have to also pay attention to in terms of the implications, other than, you know, just raising fears among voters that choosing a woman is risky, it also puts an additional burden on women candidates and their campaign teams. When I spoke with a member of Stacey Abrams' campaign team, right, so she was running to be the first black woman governor in Georgia, she said to me, you know, we had to run two campaigns. We had to run our traditional campaign to prove that Stacey Abrams is the best candidate for Georgia, right? Just like any other candidate would. But we also had to run a concurrent campaign of belief. And what she meant was we had to convince people that everybody else would vote for a black woman for governor. And that took time. It took effort, it took energy and money, you know, in terms of time spent to try to make that case. And we saw that this year on the presidential stage. So when Elizabeth Warren was bringing forward the receipts about women's success rates and doing that in her campaign stops, it was also taking away from other things she might have wanted to talk about instead. And so we have to think about as well the sort of burden that puts on women to do more work again to try to achieve the same result. And so there's some self-reflection in this moment among voters, among pundits, et cetera, to not perpetuate these ideas that women are less electable.
We're talking about what brought down the once-soaring Warren presidential campaign. Her departure from the race for the Democratic nomination has sparked questions about the role gender played in the campaign's downfall. What do you think? Did you consider Warren and then decide not to vote for her because you were afraid a woman was less likely to beat Trump? Or was there this 2016 hangover that was brought up? Or were you, I mean, in other words, did fears about other people's sexism hold you back from voting for her? Give us your thoughts at 866-733-6786. Post your questions or comments on Facebook. You can tweet us at KQED Forum or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. We're talking with Amanda Renteria, Democratic strategist and senior advisor for Emerge America, who was also national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential run. Kelly Dittmar is with us, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University. And Shane Goldmacher is a national political reporter for the New York Times. Jeff writes, I supported Warren because she looked like she was going to be reasonably to the right of Sanders, but not too far to the right. But when she announced her support for Medicare for All, she just became a Bernie clone. All us Democrats that hoped she would be the reasonable candidate left her. We couldn't go as far as Bernie, so all went to Biden. This underscores what you were saying, Shane Goldmacher, earlier, where you really think it was the Medicare for All vote in October that started her decline?
I mean, there's no question that that episode was the beginning of her decline because it put her in a squeeze, and Jeff is one of the people who was squeezing her, right? It proved for so many people that she was too much of an insider for people who were Sanders fans who wanted a revolution because she had a sort of graduated process to get there. And for Sanders fans, she was, and she was too much of an outsider for people who just wanted to beat Trump, right? She was this big, expansive program. No, we don't need this big, expansive program. We just need to beat the president. Mm-hmm. And it put her right in that middle, and it broke her away from either of the bases that ultimately ended up with Sanders and with Biden. And I would just add that, you know, having covered her pretty closely for the last few months, again, there's no question that the issue of gender infused so many things for her, and especially the issue of electability. But that is not to say she ran a flawless campaign. And at the end, the results in California really made this especially clear. She really only held appeal to white college-educated voters, which is a key part of the Democratic Party, but it is not a winning part of the Democratic Party as far as a coalition is concerned. She struggled with working-class voters. She struggled with voters of color. She won some praise from leaders in the Black and Latino communities, but it did not trickle down to the voters themselves. So, lest people think that, you know, gender sort of is an exclusive issue here. It's definitely a big part of her entire campaign arc, but certainly not the whole story.
Amanda Renteria, what do you think about Elizabeth Warren and why it seemed like she was struggling a little bit to appeal to people of color, women of color, even in some cases? And I mean, certainly people of color also, they get saddled with this electability question, too, when they're running. But why do you think Warren struggled there, if you agree with Goldmacher's assertion?
What I was there in Houston for the She the People Forum, and I have to say, in the room, and did incredibly well, had a standing ovation, had people crying in the room. She had a real connection with them that in the room it worked, but it didn't translate on TV. And I believe some of it didn't translate because she also didn't get covered quite as much. So she never had those moments consistently to show how she was reaching out to these communities. And that's one of the things I look back on and think about, what are the things that we can change? We have to make sure that women get equal time and equal chance to prove who they are and how they are making these connections.
Interesting. You know, and Shane Goldmacher, I'll go back to you only because I know we only have you till the half. The media erasure is another reason that people cite that Warren struggled. And as somebody who covered her and a member of, you know, national media, what's your response to that criticism that basically, you know, when she did great in debate, she wouldn't get the wall-to-wall momentum coverage, movement coverage that we're hearing? You know, Joe Biden's earned media after South Carolina was like through the roof. You know, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that there definitely are times where she did not get the coverage commensurate with where her campaign wanted to have her coverage. I really think right after Iowa, that was especially true, where the mess of her results, I do think, really damaged her campaign. Hmm. You didn't have results for a couple of days. And while she finished in third place, she was definitely not one of the three biggest storylines coming out of that state. the biggest storyline, right, was that Pete Buttigieg had won and surpassed expectations. Bernie Sanders had virtually tied, and that was the other big storyline. And then the collapse of Joe Biden, even if he finished behind her, was arguably a bigger story. And so somehow the third place finisher ended up not being the center of the campaign. And in the week between Iowa and New Hampshire, she made very little news. I was with her that whole week, and it was really interesting, and kept pressing her staff, why are you guys not changing anything or making sort of announcements of any kind? And they didn't. They stuck with their plan. They did even worse in New Hampshire and then in Iowa. And then, of course, she had that phenomenal debate performance in Nevada, and I do think got a wave of attention. But ultimately, that proved too late for her campaign.
Do you think she's right to take credit for bringing down Michael Bloomberg?
It's hard to argue that she didn't have a big role. I mean, campaign. If the Medicare for All debate was the beginning of a gradual decline for her, the debate in which she more or less eviscerated him was the beginning of an extremely steep decline, where his entire campaign was over a couple of weeks later.
I feel like that was also a moment when she fully embraced running as a woman. Let me go to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I was really, really sad about Elizabeth Warren dropping out. I felt that she would be the best president we've ever had. And most of my older friends, I'm pretty old, felt the same way. We were really backing her. And I think that she didn't get the coverage. You know, she's a woman. What do you expect? It just... I know women have won in 2018 and everything, but this is president, and the misogyny in this country, even among other women, is just awful. It reminded me of high school, where the girls would get together and, you know, be very much against any other girl who was smarter or cleverer or more athletic, and they would, you know, really... be up really against someone like
it's
that.
It's interesting so you it's say that. Early. Yeah, Nancy, it's interesting you say that because Kelly Dittmar, I was curious, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand initially came out and really tried to occupy that lane of woman candidate, women's issues are central, and she really didn't seem to gain traction among women for that in some cases.
Right. I mean, I think we always have to remember that women voters are not monolithic. Women voters can also harbor feelings of hostile sexism, which is what we saw both in 2016 and again in this Democratic primary. There's evidence of that even through academic studies. And sometimes we presume that women are going to simply just vote for and support all other women. And we have to be careful about that, right? Because we don't assume that in men. We allow men to have ideological diversity and differences, and we have to assume that of women, too. I think with Kirsten Gillibrand, one of the things to not overstate the fact that somehow because she embraced a sort of feminist-oriented campaign, that that was somehow her downfall. As Shane noted with Elizabeth Warren, there are a lot of other factors at play. So there were other challenges, many of which were, again, intersected with gender for Kirsten Gillibrand, including the anger at her around Al Franken. But that contributed to her candidacy as well.
Well, we're coming up on a break right now, Kelly Dittmar, but I did want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Forum. We're talking about Elizabeth Warren, and stay with us for more. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. After Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren ended her bid for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination yesterday, campaign watchers wondered whether or to what extent sexism played in the campaign's downfall. Warren called for economic reform, including breaking up big tech, canceling student loan debt, imposing a wealth tax. In farewell remarks to her staff, Warren said the campaign showed that a woman can stand up, hold her ground no matter what. What do you think? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Post your comments on Facebook or Twitter at KQED Forum. Email them to forum@kqed.org. We're talking with Amanda Renteria, who is a Democratic strategist and senior advisor for Emerge America, national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden, and Shane Goldmark, national political reporter for The New York Times. And Kelly Dittmar, I don't know if you just want to quickly finish your thought when we were going into the break there.
Yeah, I just think one of the differences to look at how Kirsten Gillibrand versus Elizabeth Warren ran vis-a-vis gender is that with Warren, you saw gender, I think, be integrated into a lot of aspects of her policy orientation, her messaging, et cetera. So it was one lens and one layered lens through which she was running her campaign. I think that's particularly effective. It shows that gender is among the assets that she brings to her candidacy, right? She can bring some unique perspective and lived experience as a woman, but that it is not the sole argument she is making for why she should be elected. And that wasn't Gillibrand's sole argument, but I do think leaning on that led to some people being concerned that she wasn't presenting a full breadth of experience and perspective.
And Jane Goldmacher, I know you need to leave us. And earlier you had mentioned that you thought one of the legacies of Elizabeth Warren's campaign was going to be her fundraising and the effectiveness of that. But I wanted to get your reaction to this comment from Marjorie, who writes, I appreciate that Warren developed plans for solving problems, challenging all of us to consider details of the candidate's promises. She also challenged us to look beyond sound bites, as it should be. And Beth writes, none of the women running in unprecedented numbers this election failed. Failing means not even trying. Elizabeth Warren accomplished a lot if anyone takes the time to remember all the great ideas she had and how she challenged the system and how it needs to change. So before I let you go, Shane Goldmacher, do you want to add anything to this question of the legacy that her campaign leaves?
Well, I think that those policy plans are, for her, hopefully, her legacy. And it's not just that she had these set of plans, but her goal is that whoever is the next Democratic president, and she hopes it's going to be in only a matter of months, makes some of those plans their agenda. And, you know, she's still going to be a United States senator. And look, this is a role she played before in 2016 when she did not run for president. She was deeply involved in Hillary Clinton's campaign, and Amanda can probably speak to this, in terms of trying to influence what staffers they were going to hire for a potential White House. She wanted to veto people she saw as too close to Wall Street or the finance industry. You know, she has not announced who she's going to support. She's obviously ideologically closer aligned to Bernie Sanders than Joe Biden. But there's no reason she couldn't try to play the same role with Joe Biden as she tried to play for Hillary Clinton, which is to be eventually a progressive validator for a moderate candidate while pulling him to the left, saying, when you agree with me, you get my support and you get the support of my fans, but you have to adopt my policies.
Interesting. That was going to be my last question, was what you made of her not endorsing yet. Anything you want to add to that quickly?
I mean, I think that's the question, right, is where does she end up going? Or does she sit it out, right? She sat out the 2016 primary between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And the relationship between Elizabeth Warren and Sanders, even if they're ideologically aligned, it wasn't great the last couple of months. If you watched her Rachel Maddow interview last night, she clearly is personally aggrieved by the sort of negative, nasty commentary from some of Bernie Sanders supporters on the internet who are tweeting at her and her staff snake emojis after she said that he had in a private meeting said that a woman couldn't win the White House. He denied making that remark. She said it was true. And his supporters really went after her on the internet. And really it soured their relationship in the last couple of months. You know, she approached him after a debate in front of cameras on national TV and said, you just called me a liar. This is a candidate, a politician who's been incredibly self-contained. I've watched her keep her cool in almost every imaginable situation. So to see her go do that, you know, she had something to say and it wasn't about to wait.
Shane Goldmacher, national political reporter for The New York Times. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you guys all.
And let me go to our callers. I'm going to go to Frances. Hi, Frances.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a woman of color. I'm a woman Warren supporter. And I have some concerns about this term electability, because I think the vernacular is problematic and very vague. And it could be a cover up for actually sexist sentiments rather than having electability tied to specific policies or specifics around a candidate's qualifications. I think electability is so subjective. And I think it's important for the media to address that and be careful about that term, electability, and also in our everyday discourse as well. And I just wanted to throw out this question to you about using that term electability.
Frances, thank you. I think you make a very important point, Kelly Dittmar. What do you think of what Frances is saying around when we talk about electability, the gendered overtones of that, the sexist overtones of that potentially?
Absolutely. I mean, if you just go back to 2016 and remember when President Trump was saying that Hillary Clinton just didn't have the presidential look, right? That she, again, wasn't electable. That's all intertwined with the expectation of what has been. And one thing that Senator Kamala Harris did this cycle when she was addressing electability concerns was to say, look, we have to look at what can be instead of what has been. And I think whenever we're having these conversations, even if we're using the term electability, but we're problematizing it in this way, I think that's actually a point of progress. And I think one other thing is when we talk about electability, you know, the graphic that was going around the internet, you know, saying she's electable if you vote for her. It's accurate, right? Electability by definition is who can get those votes. And so one of the things to push voters on, especially those who had this concern that it was too risky to choose a woman, is to say that electability concern goes away if you actually cast your ballot for her. And it's something that I think media has problematized in some respects, but certainly the ongoing narrative, I think, did contribute to some of the self-fulfilling prophecy you spoke about at the start of the show.
Well, let me go next to Tim in San Francisco. Hi, Tim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Just a really quick comment. The way I see it is the reason why she has been locked out is because the pundits of our media only think and only promote and say an angry white man like Bernie or Biden can beat an old angry white man. And I think it was just that, like who's the most angry and who's a man?
Tim, I think we may have lost you, but your point is interesting because I remember reading Amanda Renteria, a piece in the Columbia Journalism Review, that was saying that there is some evidence that what pundits say is really gaining quite a bit of influence in terms of the political discourse, as much as we like to write them off or say that we think that they're potentially, you know, or complain about, you know, these talking heads on cable television, that they really do have sway.
Yeah, they do. And it's not simply the who is speaking, but it's the way they're framing the conversation. For me, when Warren had her big night on the stage, people talked about her as attacking, almost as like a negative, right? And when you talk about men differentiating themselves, there's a very difference in the way we speak about male competition versus women competing. And it's not simply the who, but it's also the how they're speaking about the competition and the contents itself.
Well, one of the things I was so struck by when she was giving her announcement that she was ending her presidential bid was when she talked about how gender, when you discuss it, it is a trap. When you discuss sexism, that question is a trap. And let's hear some of that now.
Gender in this race, you know, that is the trap question for every woman. If you say, yeah, there was sexism in this race, everyone says, whiner. And if you say, no, there was no sexism, about a bazillion women think, what planet do you live on?
So, you know, there's this sense, right, that even bringing it up or trying to raise it as an issue in the race is problematic, right? So you can't even really talk about it. But I want to contrast what she was saying with a cut from Nancy Pelosi. She was giving her weekly news conference yesterday, and she basically said that she felt like this nation is, in fact, ready for a woman president.
I so wish every time I get introduced as the most powerful woman, I almost cry because I'm thinking, I wish that were not true. I so wish that we had a woman president of the United States, and we came very close to doing that. I do think there's a certain element of misogyny that is there. And some of it isn't really mean-spirited. It just isn't their experience. Many of them will tell you they had a strong mom, they have strong sisters, they have strong daughters. But they, you know, they have their own insecurities, I guess you would say. So I know I think America is ready for a woman president.
So the things that I'm taking away from what both of those women were saying, Kelly Dittmar, is that sexism is real, and it certainly does affect any woman who's running for office, and maybe even the highest office, it's even more pronounced, right? Mm-hmm. But that maybe it isn't as prevalent as Democrats may fear this year, or as they were making their decisions about the about how the rest of the electorate would vote.
Right. Or it doesn't need to be disqualifying. As I was saying before, I mean, talk to any woman who's been successful in politics and they've cleared this hurdle, if you will, right? So it's not fair that they have additional hurdles to clear because of sexism or gender biases, but they do. And so one of the differences in interpreting this is to say, look, even in this terrain that is sexist to a certain extent, we'll navigate it successfully, and we can navigate it successfully. So don't doubt our ability to do so. But I also think it puts a responsibility and an onus on a couple of different folks to try to push forward and through this sexism so that we actually create institutions and spaces in which it isn't harder for women. And that responsibility falls on, obviously, voters to be reflecting on their own biases. But I think there is a role here for candidates and their campaign teams to disrupt some of the biases and expectations that voters have. And we saw the women candidates, many of the women candidates, call out some of this bias, I would argue more overtly than we've seen in the past, in part because of the environment which we're in, where
like
women
Senator
are
Klobuchar.
Speaking out. Yeah, Senator Klobuchar, but also, you know, Senator Warren, there was that moment in the debate, I forget which debate, when they were asked if they would apologize or give a gift, a very sort of odd question, but the two women apologized for their emotion. And a lot of the analysis after that was like, oh, I'm so mad that these women apologized and, you know, they were feeding into stereotypes. I actually think there was a value in what especially Elizabeth Warren said in that moment, which is you will all interpret this, right, as anger or being hot, right? And that will be a negative to me. And she never said because I'm a woman, but she certainly implied that. Mm-hmm. And then she said, but here's why that anger and passion or, you know, is justified, because it's about these people that I'm concerned about. It's about these policies I care for. That's some of the education that candidates can do to disrupt some of those biased thoughts that voters have. It's call it out so that the voters have to think a little bit about their implicit and explicit biases.
Well, let me go to listener Eve in Tiburon. Hi, Eve.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what's on your mind?
Great. So I just wanted to say that I'm a huge Warren supporter. I loved her. I had been planning on voting for her. I think she was by far the best choice we had. But in the end, I ended up voting in the primary election for Biden because her numbers just sadly weren't there. And I was really disappointed to feel like I kind of had to get behind, you know, who made the most sense statistically. But I was heartbroken to make that choice. I thought she would have been a great president. And I disagree. I think we are ready for a woman president. I think I really don't believe this was a sexist choice for a lot of people. I think what people don't maybe consider is that I think Biden represents an 8-year period of peace and a political time where we all felt very comfortable and safe. And I think after, you know, 3 or 4 years of feeling really unsafe, people want to go back to a time where they felt safe. And he's the only candidate that is emotionally connected with that. And so I think when everything's, you know, this emotional, I think people want a sure thing right now.
Well, thanks for that, Eve. I mean, I think there are plenty of people who didn't vote for Warren who were not sexist. It was not based on sexism that they did not vote for her. I think what we were just talking about is whether or not they were, that those same people did not vote for her because they believed others were and that she wouldn't really have much of a chance against Donald Trump. And I wonder if that's where the safety for Biden might have come from, Amanda Renteria, in terms of how, I mean, ultimately Bernie Sanders won California and did quite well here, though the delegate math is still being figured out. But, you know, Joe Biden on Super Tuesday ended up, you know, just making that late break that I think candidates can only dream of. It's not like that happens very often.
No, it was incredibly unusual. And everybody's been talking about not only just peaking at the right time, but then his team was ready with the endorsements on Super Tuesday. And it really, everything came together. That great debate performance he had, the moment he had in the CNN town hall where he talked about his son, really, really resonated online. I will say this, running for president is incredibly difficult. And the two candidates we have had ran before and lost. And perhaps some of the message here is running for the very first time and winning is just incredibly difficult no matter who you are. And so I do want to give that ray of hope here. And for people who are running, for women who are running, sometimes it takes more than one. And it's not too much of a surprise that for president, it's oftentimes takes even more than two times.
Let's go to Robert in Berkeley. Hi, Robert.
Hi there. I was wondering what you think about the Democrats having a woman vice president candidate and if that would be a winning ticket.
Thanks, Robert. Amanda Rentry, I'll go back to you on that.
Absolutely. I think not only are women ready to serve in those roles, and I think this is one of the great pieces about this election cycle, is we now have so many women who we know are capable, who are talented, who have been on that kind of stage, and who have a following already that we can really wrap into bringing the country together, bringing the party together. And it's one of the things that, you know, for everyone that I heard from yesterday, I kept saying, listen, we are better today than we were 4 years ago. We now have women who are ready to step in, and we have an entire country who is looking for those new leaders and new voices. And so I absolutely believe not only is it a good thing to do, but it's a smart thing to do in today's politics.
Well, Lottie writes, I feel like the Democratic primary and votes came down to experience, not necessarily experience in politics, but experience with the presidency. Biden was VP and Sanders ran previously. Jennifer writes, politics in America has brought me to tears twice. The first when Obama won Iowa, and the second was yesterday when Elizabeth Warren gave her press conference to announce the suspension of her candidacy. And let me go next to Vicky in Bruce in Piedmont. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I had a comment and a question. My comment is on electability. And I think that Elizabeth Warren decided that from the beginning that she was going to run a campaign about what she stands for and not say much about what she's against. I think if she had taken the role of the voice of positive opposition and had daily critiques of what was wrong with Trump and then showing how she would fix it, she might have looked more electable. She is a good criticizer, as we saw in the debates.
Yeah.
My question is about there are some people that I know, both men and women, who said they didn't like her personality. I like her personality. I was a volunteer working for her, but I wonder if your guest could describe the so-called personality factor.
Interesting you say that. I'm going to go to you, Kelly Dittmar, on it, but I want to read Delia's comment. Delia writes, Medicare for All was a big problem. Also, her demeanor was too much teacher, too preachy, too professorial. Her speaking style is too high-pitched. Mm-hmm. Not that she's a woman. Hillary won the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly, your thoughts on personality critiques that Bruce heard and this one basically from Delia?
Yeah, I mean, I think these are those moments where you have to say, were she a man, would you evaluate the same behavior, the same emotion, the same tone of voice in the same way? And this is where those biases come through. We know from the research, and this is research from the Barbara Lee Family Foundation, that shows that women are evaluated on likability in a way that ties perceptions of likability to their qualifications for office. In other words, we're less likely to think a woman is qualified if we also don't find her likable. For men, those two things are not connected in terms of voters' evaluation. You can vote for men and think they're qualified even if you don't, quote unquote, like them. And so when we saw questions around likability early in this campaign, you know, it was important to point out that there is a different standard for women on likability than there is for men. But again, the role of media and commentators needs to be to problematize that. And I think there was some of that done. But as you can see, even in some of the comments that are coming in, that was still a different standard to which Elizabeth Warren was held and how her behavior was interpreted.
Well, Rebecca writes, a reminder, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. The majority of voters voted for her. Framing 2016 as a loss for women perpetuates the fear and the stereotype and promotes the self-fulfilling prophecy you mentioned. I mean, Amanda Rentería, that's your point, right?
Right.
And that's our point. I mean, the problem is we've just not had enough women nominees. So we don't have a lot of experience to go on. And if you go by Hillary Clinton's experience, then you're completely freaked out.
That's right.
And even though she won the popular vote.
Right. And I mean, you know, we are building the pipeline.
Yep.
And I think that's a really important point, too, which is the more we see in your hometown, right, on your city council, we are beginning to change this kind of thing. Exactly. I think one of the interesting pieces right now is everybody talks about authenticity. And that's been the big subject, right, over the last 3-4 years. And yet, when somebody's authentic, then women are judged. Well, I'm not sure I like that authenticity in this role. These are the kinds of stereotypes. These are the kinds of things we need to start breaking down, and we need to redefine what leadership looks like so that we can all really open the door to new faces and new perspectives. It's happening down ballot. We have to see it up ballot as well.
And if I could just jump
Kelly
in,
Dittmar.
You know, I wholeheartedly agree with Mena, and I think this is part of how we reframe the discussion about success and defeat in this campaign to say there was success. There was success for the women because they helped to push and redefine what leadership looked like, what we value in our presidential candidates. And one of the clear, you know, one clear example, just one moment, is when Elizabeth Warren did take down Mike Bloomberg on that debate stage. If you look beyond Mike Bloomberg's candidacy, what she said is, if you're running for president, a history of sexual harassment and a misunderstanding of gender equity should be disqualifying. And so we have to hold our candidates to a new, better, and stronger standard when it comes to this particular issue. And I think she made a strong case, and I think it was effective. That is just one way in which she was successful, in which she disrupted the institution in a way that hopefully is better and more aware and equitable of gender as we go forward.
Well, let me go next to Vaughn in Pleasanton. Hi, Vaughn.
Hi, Vaughn. Hi. My point is, I don't think it had anything to do with being a woman in 2020 race. It had to do with, in the beginning, Biden was sold as the most electable. And he continued to be the most electable until a couple surveys came out and said he's not so electable because he messed up. But and then
you mean the polls were consistently showing him as the most electable, you mean, especially initially?
Right, yeah. And so it got to be once he won an election, the whole world switched over to him. All the politicians piled on, all the endorsements showed up to him. I don't think the women or anybody other than Biden had a chance once it looked like he might win, because now he's got all the money. He's got everything. He didn't even campaign anyone. I think in this case, in 2020, it was because Biden had the go, and all he had to do was show that he was alive, and then he got the whole butt with him.
Vaughn, thanks for that. You know, okay. He raises an interesting point, too, for me, Amanda Rentería, where I did see one analyst say that polls that consistently showed Donald Trump beating Elizabeth Warren in, like, these head-to-head matchups are often polls that are also viewed by the liberal educated electorate who might have been inclined to vote for her. I mean, as somebody who was, you know, working on Hillary Clinton's campaign, how do you think we should understand polls? How damaging are polls, or how helpful are polls?
Well, they're particularly damaging if media is not paying attention to women, because by and large, that means your poll number is going to be smaller, right? Because people aren't following you in the same way. Mm-hmm. But I also want to make the point to the caller that just called in. It is interesting to see how many chances Biden got, mm-hmm. right? We all just talked about one moment, perhaps October, you know, right around that October 3rd, where Warren had the Medicare, right? And it was that one moment. But you could probably, we all on this call could probably come up with a couple of moments for Biden. And yet he gets more chances.
Well, Lois writes, not only is how the media positions a candidate critical, so is the visuals of the candidate. The media pictured Joe Biden from an angle looking up, making him appear presidential. Warren, by contrast, was pictured from angle down, making her look small, or pictured straight on. A visual bias. Kelly Dittmar, do you think there was a visual bias with Warren?
You know, it's something I haven't paid that close attention to, so I can't say yes or no, but I think these are the types of things we have seen historically in terms of differences, and oftentimes what it is images of women looking far less attractive or angry, right, cueing some of the stereotypes that, again, might work to their disadvantage. So I don't know if that was the case in this race. For me, the visual that I was focused on throughout the race was those pinky promises. And I think in this moment when we're reflecting on the campaign and looking to the future, that's the visual that I think sticks with me the most and that maybe we could focus on as the point of progress, which is, you know, waiting for those some of those little girls to sort of cash in on that promise decades from now to be running for president themselves.
Well, do you think we've made progress on the idea of a leader as having to have masculine traits or masculinity being an important way of gauging their leadership qualities?
I think so. Yeah, I do. I think that these women, I think that Hillary Clinton contributed to that. I think that when they talked about especially their distinct experiences and perspectives as women, as something that is a value added to the presidency, that disrupts the expectation that masculinity is the sort of standard by which presidentiality should be measured. I will say, though, the contrast is Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has doubled down on masculinity as the most important thing in a presidential candidate. And so what's going to be interesting is how whoever the nominee is from the Democratic Party, how they navigate masculinity in a way that is in contrast to Donald Trump instead of, I hope, not doubling down and trying to play on that terrain.
And Amanda Renteria, with just less than a minute we have, I wonder what you think, as Shane Goldmarker was mentioning, in terms of the policies that she put forward, you think would be wise for one of the candidates to adopt, right? And also what you think of her vice presidential prospects.
I think they're great. I think everyone's going to be looking at women for vice president as a woman, and she certainly is there. And, I want to just end with this. Both, you know, what she said last night on Rachel Maddow, she knew this was going to be hard, and she did it anyway. Hillary Clinton said the same thing when she started as president. She knew it was going to be hard, and she did it anyway. And so women who are out there that feel like they woke up and this is hard to stay in it, we have leaders and role models who did it anyway.
Amanda Renteria of Emerge, Kelly Dittmar of Rutgers University, thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mina Kim. Thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. Have a wonderful weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.